So, welcome to Food Conversations Season 3. Food Conversations is a program about everything to do with food, starting with planting seeds, of course, and then on to growing, harvesting, distributing, and of course, eating, with a special emphasis on establishing food sovereignty in the Shoe Swap. I'm your host, Warren Bell, and you're listening to us on CKVS FM 93.7, the voice of the Shoe Swap, community radio for the people, with the people, and by the people. Now, before we continue, again, I would like to acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility. Well, today I'm delighted to welcome back to Food Conversations a guest we had recently, Sue Moore, who is the owner emeritus of Sadoa Farm and now living in the mighty metropolis of Salmon Arm. And I am delighted to say is in our studio as our very first guest since the very first show in studio. Sue, welcome to CKVS and Food Conversations.
Thank you, Warren.
Absolutely delighted to have you here again. And today we have a plan that listeners can, we hope, come back to again and again. We're going to record as we do with our shows. We're going to put it into a podcast. And Sue and I are going to run through what she's called Plant and Soil Needs 101. That's Gardening 101. And Gardening 101 is all you need to know about setting up a garden, something that more and more people are doing in the world today. One of the things that Sue had written in her notes was that for seniors, gardening is one of the most primal activities that a person can engage in, and many, many people do that. I remember, Sue, that organic gardening had from Rodale, the Rodale Institute, had a listing of how many millions of Americans actually have a garden. It's really quite astonishing how many people actually do garden.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you can garden. Not, you don't need half an acre to garden. You can garden in three pots on your porch.
On your porch, I know. And we'll be hopefully saying things that people who have three pots and a porch can use, and people who have an acre or even more can also use, although they're probably doing it already in a highly professional way. And by the way, Sue used to have 26 acres out of garden in the Notch Hill area.
126.
That's right. But the number of acres that you had in a market garden?
16.
Well, there you are. I'll never make it through the arithmetic course desired in the education system. So, Sue, let's start off sort of at the beginning. Let's say somebody has never had a garden before. They have anything from three pots and a balcony to a couple of spaces in their yard that they'd like to convert to growing useful food and beautiful flowers, perhaps. What's the first thing that if somebody walked into your space and said, I need to learn how to do this, where do I put my garden? Where's the best place? Now, you can probably give a lot of answers to that question.
Well, basically, your plant needs three things. It needs food, it needs water, and it needs sunshine.
Sounds like humans.
So you can deal with food and water quite easily. Sunshine is something very different. And if you had three pots on a balcony and you were facing south, you would, of course, be able to grow beautiful tomatoes and various hot weather things. But if you were facing north, you may not be able to grow those at all, or if so, with less success. So the best situation is like a pot on wheels, so that you can move it with the sunshine.
Sure.
And that's where growing in pots has a great advantage over growing in the ground.
That's for all you pot growers. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that, should I? For all those people out there who are growing food in pots, you now know that you have something over the people who are growing things in the ground. You have a mobile garden. And that's something of some interest, because there are people who live in settings where the sun isn't immediately accessible in the immediately obvious place they would put their pots, but they could move them somewhere else where they could actually get light.
Absolutely. And if you're going away for 2 or 3 days and you have your pots in a blazingly hot area, you can move them to a cooler area. They'll need a little bit less water and your plants will survive. So it's quite a feat.
Indeed. Speaking of water, I'm sure listeners today will remember that we had a beautiful overnight rain and the rain changed and cleansed the atmosphere, and we're now in spring, and spring is a time when plants grow enormously quickly sometimes, and they're all around us. We're just surrounded with such blessing.
Yeah, and seeing that the rain was coming, I mean, I'm just committed to reading the weather forecast every 3 or 4 hours. It's my one addiction. And but seeing that the rain was coming, I rushed out and grabbed my lettuce and cauliflower and onions and got them planted just before the rain came.
I think that's a wonderful addiction to have. I hope you don't seek a cure, Sue. I think that's a wonderful thing to be paid. And for anybody who's interested in the garden, maybe that's part of Gardening 101, is becoming a little bit aware all the time of what weather patterns are like and what's coming up the next day and next few hours to prepare your plants and to protect them or to help them along.
Absolutely, and to know whether or not your plant will survive in a cooler situation, mm-hmm. or whether, like a tomato or a pepper or a sweet potato, they're gonna really need to be protected with this cooler weather.
We're starting to talk about food, and I'm sure some of our listeners are going to get hungry before the end of this show, with any luck. So, water, light. We've talked about water and light. Now, the third thing, of course, is food, which when we grow food, we're growing food because we're going to eat it. But plants need food as well.
Absolutely.
So just in general terms, what are the sort of basic parameters of the food that plants need?
Well, you need food to grow the plant the way you want. So, for instance, if you're growing a lettuce or a spinach or something very leafy, you need a fairly high nitrogen content. You need food so that the roots grow, and every plant needs to grow good, strong roots to produce a good, strong plant. And then you need food to make your flowers grow. And anything like a tomato or a pepper, even a broccoli or a cauliflower, what you're eating is the flower. So you need to have a really balanced or something that promotes the growth of flowers. So that's where your NPK comes in.
N is for the greens. That's N is for nitrogen, right?
Correct.
Did you see how good I am at this? P is for phosphorus.
Correct.
And K, for everybody who knows Latin, of course, they all know it stands for kalium, which is the K in Latin, meaning potassium.
Correct.
Yeah. And they each service one part of the plant's essential structure.
Yeah, there's a lot of trace minerals and various other things that a plant requires. And if you're growing in the ground here on a large scale, you have to be aware of things like your boron. Sure. May need to be replaced or replenished from time to time. But for the most part, it's the NPK. And then having your soil balanced, alkalinity, acidity, so that the plant can actually eat the food.
Now, you can get devices, can you not, to measure, especially alkalinity, the acidity, alkalinity of the soil. You can get devices that can actually calculate that, right?
You can. There's several different types. I found that the ones where you get your soil and you mix it with water and you use a litmus paper or a test tube with a gauge for the color are much better than the ones that you actually just kind of stick in the soil.
They're more accurate?
I find them more reliable. Yeah. They give you a more reliable reading, yeah.
Well, there you are. Their first concrete bit of advice today, how to get a device to measure the acidity or alkalinity of your soil and how important that can be. Now, we talked about siting. What about level versus sloping land? I mean, this is a bit of an issue in this part of the world because pretty well everything, all the land around here slopes. One way or another. What would you say about that kind of principle? What's better? They're not necessarily better or worse, they're just different. What about the lay of the land would you say is relevant?
If you are a farmer and you have a sloping field, you get more hours of growing time on a slope than you do on a flat because of the way the plants are shaded, et cetera. And you can take that into consideration. Mm. But for most backyard growers, the thing that I would be concerned about would be water.
Okay.
So for instance, if you have a timed irrigation system that's going to sprinkle water, you will get a lot more water at the bottom of your slope than you do at the top of your slope. So you'd have to take that into consideration.
I see. So you'd apply water near the top knowing that it would end up down at the bottom eventually anyway.
Absolutely. And if you had a drip irrigation system, mm-hmm. you should run the water not from the bottom up, but from the top.
For sure, for some top down.
Top yeah. down.
Interestingly, we have timers in. We have a small garden at our place, and we have timers, and I've always found them extremely helpful because you can sort of set them and then know that they will shut off at a particular point. Do you think for most gardeners that can be a useful tool? I did find it that way, but.
I think it can be a useful tool, especially early in the growing season when everything needs water.
Yeah, yeah.
By the time you get into, say, August, and you're trying to dry your onions.
You don't need wet onions.
But the leeks next to them still need a lot of water. So it's you know, that's where you get into possibly a drip irrigation system is a lot better. It also uses a lot less water.
Now, we've talked about light, sunlight, we've talked about water, we've talked about food. Say you have a property and you have some space where you'd like to put in a garden, but it's either lawn, a very old-fashioned but still popular kind of thing, which we're moving away from as we realize that space can be used for growing things that we use. When you say, okay, I want up the garden over here, we've decided on a place, there's adequate sun, we have figured out how to bring it water to it, and we have some seeds or we have some seedlings or starts ready to go. How do you turn that space into the rudiments of good quality soil that you can grow in?
It's really hard to do it right now. I think that if you wanted to grow your garden on that patch now, the best thing to do would be to remove pathways of the grass. Just take a thin line off of the top and put that into your compost.
Okay.
Then where you have the grass left, you could put down cardboard or some other mulch material, hay mm-hmm. or straw, to keep that from growing up and taking food from your food crop and shading it out. Okay. So then you have these strips of earth left, and I would, if it's really compacted, I would double dig.
Mm-hmm. Double dig meaning?
Double dig meaning two shovels deep.
Okay. All right.
Okay. And to do that, what you would do is you would take out a small patch, one shovel deep, and then take that and put it, say, in a wheelbarrow, dig over that bottom piece, and then gradually go down your row.
Okay.
So that you only have to take something out once. And then when you get to the other end of your row, you can just pop the soil in your wheelbarrow back into the on the top of the other end of the row.
Would you add anything to the soil?
Not while I was digging.
Okay. Right.
But once I dug, I would add a good quality compost.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where it would be really good to take a soil test so that you knew if you had any nitrogen or other nutrients in the soil. You can probably pick up a test kit for $20 or so from your local garden center.
And that would be a test kit that would test for nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium and acidity?
Especially the NPK.
Right.
The acidity is also a good one, but it's difficult to do anything about rebalancing your soil quickly.
It takes time,
and it would be good to take that test in, especially in the fall, so that you can rebalance your soil over the winter months.
Now, you said this isn't a good time to be doing this, but that's because of the time of the season. We're already advancing into the spring, and it's a little late to get started. Is that what
you mean? Your garden should be ready to put the seeds in.
So when would you say a garden, the soil, let's say that the soil is the basic ingredient in the garden. I mean, there's, of course, these other things we talked about, but the soil is sort of a bedrock on which you have to rest the growing process. When should you have all that kind of lined up and ready to go? I mean, we live in the Shuswap here, and it's got a microclimates from one place to the next. You're on one side of a hill or the other side, and it's a totally different climate. But say, in and around the sort of Salmon Arm area, what would be the time when you want to have everything ready to go?
Well, I would say it should be ready to go now, or it should have been ready to go 2 or 3 weeks ago. Okay. But the time to prepare is the year before.
Okay. So you can work on the soil before you even start planting anything in your garden.
Absolutely.
Well, that's a good point. That's a very good point. The traditional date for starting to plant presumably frost-sensitive plants in the garden has always been the May long weekend. However, your humble host planted some tomatoes about a month earlier, a couple of years in a row, and got away with it. We had protective measures in place but didn't have to use them. What is the time you would say when... is it changing? It's changing with climate. The climate is changing. Would you say there's a reasonably ideal time to start planting this? I know different food crops grow at different rates and under different circumstances. When's the time when you can start putting something into the garden?
As a farmer, I have planted seeds in the garden and taken crop out the first week in May. Now, that was a very unusual year, and we're talking cut lettuce, salad, turnips, and arugula. We're not talking, tomatoes by any means.
I like arugula.
So once the soil is dry enough to be worked, once you feel that it's ready and you can get going, you can plant your cool weather crops fairly early. And then we have this wonderful product called Rime.
Oh, yes.
And
just describe what Rime is. I've used it, but just describe it for listeners so they know what it is.
It's a floating row cover. And you can get it in different thicknesses. You can get it to give you between 2 and maybe even up to 10 degrees of frost protection.
Hmm.
I used to use it in my tunnels. We would plant really early, and then should the weather start really heavy frost, we would just put the reme out. It keeps the warmth in the ground, and it's the warmth in the soil which is really important.
So with say a backup protection like reme, we actually got some big old plastic fruit bottles, cut the bottoms off and put them over the tomato plants. We felt very ingenious when we did this. I hope it worked.
You can use any kind of protection. I mean, if you're just doing it at night, something like, please, Dairyland, forgive me, a Dairyland crate over the top of your tomato.
Dairyland has to forgive you. You're doing too much good work.
And a sack.
Sure.
Or an old sheet.
Yeah,
your wife's jacket that you hate. Anything that you need, you can put on the top of, and that will protect your tender plants.
So it's just a barrier that traps heat.
It's just a barrier that traps heat and prevents the frost, which often will only be there for say 1 or 2 hours, from damaging any of your leaves.
Have you noticed a change in the onset of seasonal weather changes over the last, say, 20, 30 years?
Absolutely. I mean, even this year, it's really cold. Mm-hmm. But we haven't, where I live, I haven't had an overnight frost for quite a while. Mm. And I'm actually not expecting one. It may go down to 1 degree or 2 degrees, but I'm still not expecting that frost to come in, whereas in previous years that would be unheard of, the temperature variation, hotter days, colder nights, and we're getting something which is more ambient.
Yes, we are. And it's fascinating. We happen to be blessed to live in an area where climate change alterations in climatic patterns will actually in some respects benefit the growing of food, whereas in many other places it's getting either way too hot or way too wet, or there are too many extreme weather events. Let's say you've got the soil prepared. You started last year, and you've got some places that you can plant food crops in. What would you say, let's say we're starting off chronologically with regard to the weather, what would be the first things you would consider planting early that would be likely to do well in the cool weather?
Straight into the ground. Mm-hmm. Straight into the ground. First of all, I would recommend that you get a really good quality seed catalog.
Okay. Before we get anything to the ground, we get the seeds.
And in the seed catalogs, they have a planting guide. And that guide, Once you understand that guide and your own weather situation, you can use that guide, or you can put, you know, you would put the product in 2 weeks later or 1 week earlier or whatever. And your spinach, green onions, radishes, where are we? Arugulas, your mustards, some of your turnips can go into the ground first, really early. Doesn't matter if it freezes a little bit.
And would some of those, would those need to be protected against frost, or would they be a bit frost hardy?
If you put them in by seed.
Okay, sure.
You would have them far more frost hardy.
Yes, of course.
If you want them to grow a little faster, you would protect them to give them more heat. And then the heat would help them to grow faster.
Now, when you put seeds in the ground, sometimes, unless you're very careful, they're bunched up. Why don't you talk a little about thinning? Because I've actually avoided crops that I had to thin. I've bought seedlings because I could space them out nicely. But if you put seeds in the ground, thinning becomes an important step to take.
It does. It becomes a really important step. And when For instance, if you planted some lettuce seed, what you could do is if you cut it above the growing tip, it will regrow.
Mm.
If you cut it below the growing tip, it won't. So what you could do is just cut it all above the growing tip and get a good feed of lovely greens. And then maybe 2 weeks later, you could leave one cut below the growing tip. Leave one cut below the growing tip and space them out to say 6 to 12 inches apart, according to the type of lettuce.
Mm.
That will give you another feed of lettuce. And then in a few weeks, you would get your heads of lettuce.
This leads directly to planting in sequence. What's the word for that?
Succession planting.
Succession planting. I have never mastered the art of succession planting, and I'm going to have to do it because it is such a great way for especially things like greens to get them available for a long period of time. Just describe succession planting a bit.
Well, especially as a single person, you want to put in less seeds more frequently. So, for instance, if you love radishes, you need to put in enough radishes that will last you for, say, 2 weeks. And then 2 weeks later, you put in enough radish seed to last another 2 weeks, et cetera, et cetera.
You know, it's such a simple idea, and yet it's so wonderful. It means that you take advantage of what the plant does, but you also use our little human ingenuity to add a little bit of continuity over time. And that's what you're talking about.
Absolutely. And you can do things like plant your peas. Oh, peas can go in early as well, and broad beans. But if you plant your peas in between your rows of peas, you could, for instance, put some lettuce seed, which would give you your cut lettuces. By the time your peas are out, you may get some head lettuce out of that. If not, if for instance it's gotten too shady and maybe the lettuce has molded off for you, you could just dig it up and pop in some radish seeds, because some seeds need a little bit of shade.
So, speaking about seeds, and you mentioned getting a good seed catalog, why don't you just list off some companies that you think are really good, that seed companies that you've used over the years? I mean, obviously organic is a big thing, and it's been a theme in your growing lifetime. What companies would you say, what seed catalogs would you turn to if you were looking for sound information about seeds?
Oh, my. A lot of companies have a lot of different focuses.
Right.
Down in the United States, there's High Mowing Seeds, okay, which is 100% organic.
Hmm.
Excellent. There's Johnny's Seeds, which is focused on small market gardens, and so has a lot of the varieties that aren't available in the larger catalogs.
Hmm. Any seed company in BC that you would find?
I was going to get onto that. There's West Coast Seeds.
Absolutely, I've heard of them.
Which is a great seed company, and they do have the very best planting guide for this area. Absolutely. Okay. William Dam Seeds in Ontario has been a supplier of untreated seeds for 50 years plus.
Hmm.
And has a lot of organic seeds. It's a very reliable company.
Would you say that the business, if you want to call it, the industry of producing seeds for ordinary folk, I mean, as well as for commercial growers, is changing? Is there more available now than, say, 20 or 30 years ago in terms of things like organic, things like locally adapted seeds, things like catalogs that have really good planting guides in them? Is that changing?
Oh, absolutely. And there are a number of small seed growers that you find at your Seedy Saturdays early in the spring. I think they're all over and done with now, which is unfortunate, but there's a great one in Kelowna. Sunshine Seeds produces a lot of their own seed organically. And there's a lot more interest in local gardeners producing their own seed.
One of the things that farmers have done since we've been farming as a species is trade seeds, is exchange seeds. There's been a move in the sort of industrial model for sequestration of seeds. In other words, they're patented, they're copyrighted, whatever it is. They're hidden behind intellectual property rules. I think there is a trend away from that, back to the way we've been dealing with seeds from, as the indigenous folk would say, time immemorial. What about that? What about that trend towards more free exchange of seeds, more free distribution of seeds from one person or one farm or one grower to another? What trend do you see there?
Well, personally, I'm all for it. I believe that if you don't have control of your seed, then you don't have control of your garden. And if you don't have control of your garden, you don't have food and you're dead.
That's an interesting sequence. Not a pleasant one in the very end.
Yeah. But, you know, like when it boils down to it, you really need to have control of your own seed. There are cooperative seed companies. There's a BC seed cooperative. There's one in the United States called Fedco. Mm. There's Seed Savers Exchange, Seeds of Diversity. So there's a number of seed focused groups that are fighting to retain integrity in the local seed movement.
And is that growing? I mean, do you see that expanding, this sort of resurgence of the free flow of seeds from one grower to another? Is do you see that? I mean, I've been to the Seed Savers event in Enderby for a number of years, doing presentations on one thing and another, and I'll just enjoying the atmosphere. And their seed exchange is a very busy place. That room where people can bring seeds with a little label saying what qualities it has, and then somebody else can take those seeds and leave some of their own, that kind of thing.
For the small gardener, mm-hmm. I see that really being very important, and yes, a growing movement. For the farmer, I think it's a little more difficult because of the quantity of seed required and because of the integrity of that seed. You need to be guaranteed that if you're going to plant a green zucchini, it's going to be a green zucchini and not a spaghettini. So there's you need to be able to rely on your source. If you're a home gardener and you get something that's a little bit of an off type, it really doesn't matter that much as long as it's edible.
So are there two separate markets then? Large-scale growers versus small-scale growers, amateurs, people doing it for the pleasure and the personal satisfaction and for their own food. Is it like two separate worlds, or are they kind of crossover a bit?
I think they're intermingled, and I really feel that the people who are growing for the home gardener need to have the integrity to know how to grow their seed. And to grow their seed and to sell it as advertised. Mm. But it's just that slight amount of insecurity for the farmer. And you need to have seed cleaning equipment and be able to clean your seed to a certain standard to go through the seed seeding equipment that farmers need to seed their fields.
Yes.
If you have a lot of husks, for instance, left in your onion seed, it won't satisfactorily go through seeding equipment.
You will not be popular with the farmer.
You will not be popular with the farmer. So, and also sizing seed. And again, if you grow beet seed, it can come in all different kinds of sizes. Mm. But you need to be able to size it so that a farmer can put it in with seeding equipment.
By the way, I maybe should tell listeners that Sue is going to be at the Teaching Garden, the Shuswap Food Action Society's Teaching Garden, at the north end of 30th Street, Northeast. Sue, when is the garden going to be on, and when will you be there?
I'll be there tomorrow.
Tomorrow?
Tomorrow, yes, from 9 till noon. I will be selling some plants down there. And I grow plants for the Teaching Garden. The Teaching Garden has workshops and work bees that assist people in learning how to garden. And the food that's grown from the garden goes to the volunteers who work at the garden and to the food bank.
It's a complete circle and a wonderful thing. And we're very lucky to have this kind of process taking place in our community and to have you involved with it, Sue, because you are, as everybody can tell now, a gold mine of information. Now, Sue was born and raised several decades ago in England, and her first garden was on an allotment next door to the largest tube train refurbishment site just northeast of London. Sue, let's say we've got some soil, we've prepared it last year, we've decided to put in the cool weather crops of some radishes, some peas, some arugula, which is my current favorite leafy green thing. What are we going to do next? What do we have to have set up in place? Say we've checked the soil to make sure that there's adequate amounts of NPK, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. We have a system for watering the ground as needed. And we've got these cold weather crops. What are we going to do next?
Well, next we're going to take a look to see if we have any crops that need succession planting, and possibly plant a few seeds. It is possible to plant a little short row of broccoli or cauliflower in your garden, and then you dig them up and transplant them. So that way you don't have to worry too much, Warren, about getting your seeds too close together. But now is the time to think about, have I got my carrots in? Have I got my beets in? What do I really like to eat?
That's a very good point.
You know, eggplants are such a gorgeous plant to grow. They're absolutely lovely. But what's the point if you don't like eating them?
I love eating eggplant, and thank you for even mentioning the word on air.
And, you know, the same with the tomato and the cucumber. I mean, okay, so my favorite thing to eat is Greek salad. So I want to grow tomatoes, I want to grow peppers, I want to grow cucumbers, I want to grow Walla Walla onions.
Walla Walla, because they're sweeter?
They are so sweet. And, you know, your onions could be in right now. Your cucumbers, peppers, and tomatoes could be growing on your windowsill, just ready to plant. Or you could be going down to your local gardening store and just checking to make sure that they are going to have the varieties that you like.
Could we just pause for a moment and talk about the advantages and disadvantages, compare and contrast seedlings or starts versus starting from seeds, and what are the differences between those two approaches? I mean, they're similar but they're related, but they have some differences.
There are a number of things. One is we have a very short growing season. Unlike Mexico, we don't grow for 12 months of the year. So we need to put something into the ground that's going to produce something that's going to be edible before the frosts hit. So to put in a tomato plant. Let's work on tomato plants, everybody's favorite. So you put in a tomato plant. You can put it in with a little bit of added nutrition. You want the flowers to grow. So a small first letter, low N, higher PK. Bone meal is excellent. Pop a little bit in with your plant when you put it in. Now, if your plant tag says that your tomato is 65 days, that's probably 65 days from transplant, not from seed.
Okay.
So 65 days from transplant would be approximately 105 days from seed. So you can
longer.
See the difference there.
Yeah, right.
So if you put in something like a Subarctic Plenty or a Super Fantastic, which is a fairly short growing season, you're going to have your tomatoes in August.
And if you're not careful, you might have tomatoes in the first frost in late September.
Exactly. So if you're going to grow your, for instance, one that says on it 95 days, you have to make sure that it has the optimum growing, that you it will probably be an indeterminate tomato, and you need to stake it, and you need to prune it, and you need to give it lots of sunlight.
Let's just explain that word indeterminate so that listeners know what that means.
Indeterminate, you could say that it doesn't stop growing.
Okay.
A determinate stops growing at a certain point. A determinate tomato is usually a bush that you can just pop in the ground and let it go. And you will get nice tomatoes in August off of a determinate tomato.
Indeterminate,
you will have to stake it. You will have to prune it, which means knowing how to prune it. And you will get absolutely delicious tomatoes probably round about the same time or just a week or two later.
Hmm. So heat-loving plants obviously need to be planted when there's lots of heat. And so things like peppers that clearly love a warmer climate, when should they be added to the garden?
Well, I think that the May the 24th weekend is a good guideline, but I would also check the weather. I have had tomatoes frost out on the 1st of June. Which was not a happy experience. If I'd have checked the weather, I could have covered them up and they would have been fine. it's really hard to replace, 300 tomato plants at the last moment. So you have to be really careful. With the temperature, a plant will not grow at a heat-loving plant will not grow at less than 10 degrees soil temperature. So as soon as your nighttime temperatures are 10 degrees and your daytime temperatures would be warmer, then your plant is going to grow and thrive. If your nighttime temperatures are down at 4 and 5 and your daytime temperature is warmer, your plant is going to grow for maybe 3 hours a day, and then they're going to just sit there for the rest of the time. So bear in mind that planting a little bit later when the weather is warmer isn't going to hold you back that much.
Sure, the plants will just take off when the heat comes along.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Well, I had some basil, I remember, in pots, and it was cool, and they just looked dreadful. And then it started to warm up, and they just, as you say, it didn't matter what time you planted, they were going to wait until it warmed up, and they could really, really appreciate that heat.
Absolutely. And, like earlier, Warren, you talked about the difference between planting from seed and planting from starts. For instance, if some of the seed grows really quickly, like the winter squash, the summer squash, the cucumbers, they grow really quite quickly. And you can get a plant ready to go in the ground from seed in approximately 3 weeks at the right temperature, maybe four. So when you plant a zucchini plant into the ground, you will knock it back 1 week.
Sure.
Okay. If you took a seed and you germinated it and then put it into the nice warm soil, you bring that forward 1 week. So the difference between putting a germinated seed or a started plant into the garden is only about 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there are some nuances there. And clearly, as any gardener starts to have a few seasons under their belt, they start to recognize that, you know, you can get away with some things and you can't get away with other things. And Mother Nature is, as usual, in charge. Let's talk about some of those nuances. We have already talked about what you called in one of your notes, pushing the season. In other words, taking a chance, looking at the weather. Obviously, this is where an obsession with weather reports comes in, making sure that you won't have a disaster, but kind of pushing the margins a little bit when it comes to weather. Something that we should be doing.
That you can certainly do that at the beginning of the season. And then when you get to the end of the season, you can do it also. For instance, if it's been a really cool summer and your carrots have not materialized as you would want them to, what I would do is I would go through them, thin them to approximately 3 inches so that the carrots got plenty of room to grow and can get, each individual carrot can get all the food it needs instead of fighting with its next door neighbor. And cover that with Rime. And you'll give yourself an extra 2 or 3 weeks on the season and probably will get a really good crop of carrots.
Speaking of which, I've heard of people, and many of them, leaving carrots in the ground through the winter. What does that do? And then they say in the spring they're sweeter. Is that an urban myth or a rural myth or just a myth?
No, that's perfectly true. That's perfectly true. If you refrigerate a vegetable, it will often enhance the sugars. Some vegetables it depletes the sugars, but some, like the root vegetables, it enhances the sugars. So you can leave them in the ground. Occasionally, they will survive without any damage whatsoever, without you covering them. If you cover them with a little bit of straw or a little bit of hay, they will almost certainly survive, and you will get your carrots in the spring. However, you can't leave them in to size up. They have to be a reasonable size already. Because what will happen in the spring is that the carrot is a biennial, which means, oh, this is the second season.
We're going to have fun
now. I want to go to flower.
So you'll have carrot flowers in your garden.
And carrot flowers are nothing to be ashamed of. They host your ladybirds, and they look beautiful, and it's not a problem. However, the carrot is not particularly edible.
Which is probably something that would disappoint somebody who pulled it up and tried to eat a piece of wood. We're coming close to the end of the show, and there's so many things we'd be talking about. We've only scratched the surface, but one thing that you've mentioned in some of your notes here is harvesting and how you harvest crops, because that can have it. We've already talked about succession planting and cutting off lettuce above the growing tip. And that kind of thing. I must mention a particular thing that I did, and it turns out I read your notes. I think I did the right thing. And that's with kale. I cut off the bottom leaves and left the top, the crown of the plant, and I ended up with stems that were 5 and 6, nearly 6 feet tall, still growing kale leaves at the top and making great kale chips, which I shared with a number of people. This is another thing about harvesting. You can do it in such a way that you maintain the plant base to some degree as well.
Yes, with some crops like the kale that you've mentioned and chard in particular, if you take the leaf and break it off, you take it down and break it off, it does better when it's early in the morning, when it's nice and crisp and easy to break. This will help to prevent any kind of rot forming on the piece of damaged leaf that you've left behind. So take that off and use your chard and kale, and you will get beautiful greens all through the year. You can do this a little bit with spinach early in the spring. Fantastic. And those zucchini, cut them when they are the size that you buy in the store, when those nice 7-8 inch zucchinis. Take them when they're a nice size. If you don't want them, just put them in somebody's car at the parking lot. But if you don't take them, your zucchinis will stop growing. You will get one massive great big zucchini or two massive great big zucchinis. You don't know what to do with them, and you don't get any nice little zucchinis to put in your stir fries.
I can look into my memory bank and see some very large zucchinis all by themselves in the garden, and not as flavorful and tender as the little ones. We're going to come to an end now, but I want to mention to listeners that Sue is going to be bringing some of her seedlings to the Sorrento Farmers Market. The days will vary, but she will be there with her seedlings, and they're all organic. They're grown with a great deal of love and attention and support in every way, both through the NPK and sunlight and water ingredients that are essential for plants. So you're going to have an opportunity also at the teaching garden to hear some of Sue's vast knowledge of experience. We're going to end today. I just want to say thank you to you, Sue, for coming in, and how much fun it is to have you live in the studio here, because we can really exchange back and forth so much more readily. And we're going to have Sue back at some point to answer questions, which we hope you'll send in by email. You may be getting one right now, to ask some specific questions about specific issues. So thank you again, Sue, for being here, and we look forward to having you on the show again in the future.
Thank you, Warren. It's been a pleasure.